What's up, everyone? I'm Zach, your host of the Auxoro podcast, where music artists, athletes, entrepreneurs, and other interesting human beings dive deep into the story beyond the surface. This episode is brought to you by The Aux. The Aux is a short-form podcast produced by Auxoro, bringing you a daily dose of uncensored wisdom to jumpstart your life. Five-minute episodes, no bullshit, no topic off-limits. We explore things like fashion, pornography, relationships, meditation, and more. You can subscribe to this podcast by searching The Aux, A-U-X, wherever you listen to podcasts, or by visiting the link in the description. This time, we sat down with Rabel, a singer-songwriter who has made music with artists like Kygo, Marshmello, Kesha, and Pink, just to name a few. The night before this podcast, I saw Rabel live in New York City and was blown away by his performance. He commands the stage and is unapologetically himself as a performer. I was excited to talk to Rabel because he makes music that I love. 11 Blocks is my jam, and we spoke about many topics that can apply to anyone, even outside of music. So on this episode, Rabel discusses coming out, getting sober and its effect on the creative process, the do's and don'ts of breakups, and more. Rabel is a cool guy, super genuine. He's a beautiful soul. And I'm extremely excited that we had the chance to talk. I definitely got a lot out of this conversation and from hearing his perspective. And I hope that you find some things in this conversation that you can latch on to as well. So without further ado, here's our wide-ranging conversation with Rabel. 'Cause my mind won't stop, it's just 11 blocks. I know that's your home. 'Cause it's Friday night, you're not that time. I know that's your home. So last night, that was an incredible show. And what I kind of picked up on, and I'm sure everyone else picked up on, is that you do crazy stuff with your voice. Like your range, you do crazy shit. Like the notes that you're able to hit, the highs and lows. How did you start to develop the feel for your voice early on?
Well, thank you. I don't know. I started singing like in church, which I feel like is like the most cliche thing ever. But I started doing that, and then I was in like all these weird choirs. So the high notes actually make me think of like, I was in Houston Boy Choir.
Yeah.
Like a soprano when I was like in sixth grade or something, singing like weird operas. I've tried like a bunch of different stuff, like musical theater and choir stuff and like jazz vocal stuff. So I don't know, maybe through all that somehow I...
What do you think about church music? Because I started going to church, I was probably like 7 or 8 years old with my parents, and I don't really go anymore. It was a big part of my life. I went to a private Catholic high school, got away from it. But early on, I just remember how miserable I was listening to the music in church. Like it was some 90-year-old lady on the organ that was on life support trying to like sing.
That was like me.
Yeah. And I was like, yo, if you're trying to get people hype about a religion, like if you need the energy in a room, the music that they were playing is not, it wasn't it. I was like, this is...
I always went to like the hipster churches. So they were playing like weird, like Coldplay, like...
They're playing Coldplay in church?
Like Coldplay worship songs. Yeah. So there's always like a really emotional guitar solo and everyone's crying. And you're like, whoa.
That's cool though, because I feel like that gets more people to pay attention. And you can deliver the message through the music, I guess,
more
effectively.
There was definitely a lot more energy than like a Catholic church, kind of like, and then the books with the music. And you're like, none of us know how to read music. Why do they give us these books? It's like a room full of 300 people that are like, what is this?
Are you familiar with the comedian Chris D'Elia at all?
Yeah.
Have you heard his joke about how weird church is? Like when you actually... So he used to go to church a lot when he was a kid, as many people did. And then didn't go for probably 15 years and then went back as an adult. And he was riffing for 5 or 6 minutes just on how weird church is. Like the call and response and how every 5 or 6 minutes someone's just going like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like the priest sings everything that yeah. like in the name of the Holy Spirit bought something from IKEA yesterday. Like, and he says a way in his Crystalia style way, like people are just losing their shit in the audience. But I was like, yeah, that's so true. Like if you just didn't know anything about church and then you sat in on a service, you'd be like, what kind of cult is this? Like, it's the weirdest shit I've ever seen. Like, people are just singing randomly.
But you get wine,
eating bread,
cracker.
Yeah. It's a good time. Maybe I'm going to go back to church after this podcast.
Appetizer spread. Sometimes you get a welcome gift.
Yeah.
I got a pack of Oreos and a mug.
Is this at the hip church?
No. The hip church gave me no welcome package.
So, another thing... Another
just
we
a lot
have
of
a,
emotional
we should have a welcome.
Trauma.
We should I want to get to that.
Oh boy.
And that makes me feel like we should have a welcome package for the podcast. I've thought about it. I just don't know what
just get like
we would
a
do.
Mug and a pack of Oreos.
Yeah. That's what it's going to be.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. How'd you come up with this welcome package? Well, Rabel said we should get a mug and a pack of Oreos.
I got that from a really nice Anglican church on Hollywood Boulevard one time. St. Thomas, where you at?
Yeah. So another part of your performance, which I loved, was the improvisational aspect between songs. There's, like, you even alluded to it at some point. You said, like, I feel like I'm doing stand-up right now, like, kind of. And because I feel like not everyone is that present and aware as a performer. Like, and everyone has different styles. Like, some people are just more locked in on the music. Totally. And then they say, you know, they might just be like, this next one is blah, blah, blah. And then like they just start singing and that's fine. But I really enjoyed how you were engaging with the audience and saying like, oh, I love that shirt. Or people were screaming out like, I love you. And then you're telling these life stories that had to do with the song somehow and giving people fashion tips. How did that kind of enter into your performance style?
I feel like I never like had a performance style. So I feel like it just kind of came from, I don't know, I'm just kind of like sitting up there and I was very aware that like I'm sitting up here and you guys are out there and I got a microphone in my hand. Yeah. So like, okay, here we go. So yeah. I feel like I end up being sometimes too present in the moment. But then it makes every show for me is different. Like I don't really know what, I usually know somewhat what I'm going to play, but like what I'm going to say, I have no idea. So it makes it fun for me because, you know, you tour, you go play almost every night. Yeah. It keeps it fresh when you're like making a stupid joke about eBay and you're like, this is fun.
Yeah. And it's stuff that everyone can relate to. And everywhere is different. So I'm sure you pick up on things in one venue or someone's wearing something or someone shouts something where you're just like, oh, like... that's kind of cool. That reminds me of this story.
Totally.
And then you have, you know, however long you want to take between songs, maybe you want to take a couple minutes and just be like, let's vibe out.
Right.
Let's talk about some shit for a second.
And then sometimes I talk for way too long and it completely doesn't land.
I'm like, cool, thank you. 15 minutes later, you've played two songs and
that happened like in, where was it? Atlanta or something. I literally did like a 4-minute bit about Old Navy. And I was like, at the end, I was like, cut the mic off like in between songs. Don't let me do this again.
Did you say that out loud?
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Was this the Elon Musk joke as
it
well?
It was the Elon Musk joke. It was just about convertible cargo pants.
Okay. Okay.
It's pretty genius.
I would buy those. I would buy those for sure. Vulnerability, I think, is something that shines for you on stage. And... you know, I grew up playing baseball and it's kind of like a hyper masculine sports environment. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of room for vulnerability in sports, especially as a dude. And it kind of made me think of like how vulnerability is not portrayed as much of a strength that it should be, especially for guys to be introduced to that when they're younger. And like everyone's introduced to that at certain stages. But like for me, I think it was kind of like pushed back because of sports. Once I stopped playing baseball, kind of had to actually confront a lot of the things that I was feeling rather than just replace it with competition. Cause then I'll take it out on the competition and be like, all right, I'm going to focus on this and I'm going to put all my anger and all my energy towards this game for 3 hours. And when I was watching you on stage, I was like, this guy is saying things about his ex-boyfriend, people that have hurt him in his life on top of singing songs about them. Like singing songs is enough to make you like to fuck someone off and be like, damn, like that really hit me. And then kind of like talking about it, I'm just appreciative of you being able to talk about that stuff on stage.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Where does that come from, do you think?
I kind of don't know how else to be. I feel like sometimes I say too much. I feel like I never say too little. But I don't know. I've never had a kind of through the past however long I've been doing this, I've never really had a wall between me and, you know, whoever's listening. Because I don't even know what that wall would be. I don't really have like a alter ego or like some persona. So I'm just kind of like, some days are great, some days are not great. And I'm kind of try to just be present with that. And then to get to tour and see it kind of be met with the same and to talk to people after shows and stuff and have people share their stories. And that's so cool to feel like that space is like opened up. Because some shows you go to and it does feel very kind of cold or you almost feel like you're listening to the record, which can be really cool. And there's no shade on that. But I don't feel super cool necessarily. And I just kind of feel like I'm writing true stories. So I'm already like exposed. I already said it in the song. And so I kind of feel like I then have the freedom to just talk about whatever. And then it opens it up for people to feel whatever. Or I've people like cry. Like I forget where I was playing, somewhere in Europe. I could hear someone like audibly sobbing to one of the songs. And I was like, holy shit.
I probably would have started
crying.
But
that's so cool to feel like, it made me feel so cool to know that like somebody felt comfortable enough in a room filled with strangers to be like, fuck, this is fucking me up and I'm going to sob now.
Well, I feel like I've never been in that situation on stage, but I feel like that's what it's all about when you're writing. Could be something in your bedroom about a very specific instance. And then you have millions of people that listen to it and people are identifying with it, but you don't really see it or hear it because you're not playing a live show. But then you play a show live and you actually get to see those reactions. Totally. And you're like, oh fuck, this person that didn't go through what I went through is hearing about something that I went through, but like they're projecting it onto themselves. Like something that happened that like fucked them up that you have no idea. It's like, wow, like that they're like crossing a bridge through music, which is like crazy to think about.
It is very, it's awesome. It's one of my favorite parts of getting to tour and actually getting to see the connection that someone's making to your songs and your stories and stuff like that.
I want to talk about 11 Blocks for a little bit because that song is about your ex-boyfriend. I've never been good about writing or talking about my past relationships. So from a songwriter's perspective, do you feel better having gotten it out there, or is it more of a reminder because you have to sing it all the time? Like how, and when you're from actually writing the song to making it to having to perform it and hearing it play all over, how is that working with your own process of kind of like getting back to peace with yourself?
I think for me, it was really cathartic. I definitely, like I remember the night that song came out, I was actually in New York walking down the street and like open it up and the album artwork is like a map, like from one house to the other.
And you have the tattoo of it.
I have the tattoo on my arm. And I called my manager and was like, do we make a mistake? Like, is this too much? This like real, that's my real life. Like the album art is like traced from Google Maps.
You thought the album art was a mistake?
Just the whole everything. I was like, this is so literal. And it kind of freaked me out. But then to see people's reactions to it and kind of like you were saying, like just to hear people hearing their own story in it and sharing that with me was so powerful and kind of, I don't know, that song for me now, it almost feels like a victory lap or something every night when I get to sing that. Because it feels like I'm in a totally different place now. And songs for me are kind of like little reminders, but not always in a bad way. But it's weird. It is weird. And sometimes songs will sneak up on me. Like even last night, I was playing the last song with Billy called That's What I Do. Mm-hmm. And like kind of at the end, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling this so hard right now.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck, I haven't felt this. And like the feeling like of writing that song and yeah. what I felt like that day, even if yeah. it's like 3 years ago, sometimes it sneaks back in if all the fucked up stars align and you're like, why do I feel like I'm like in the middle of this unrequited love situation I was in 3 years ago?
Yeah. You know, obviously when you have to write a song, you have to write it down. I think for me, at least when I write things down, that has a super powerful effect where even though nothing really changed, I didn't do anything besides writing it down. You're kind of explaining it to yourself or you're visualizing what you were going through and you're kind of like making yourself feel it. I don't know if it's the same way with songwriting, but there would be things that I didn't want to talk about, even with my own mom or dad when I was younger, that I would just write a note and I would just go hand it to them and be like,
Yeah.
Take this. Like, this is why I'm fucking pissed at you, mom. Right. Like, and then I just walk away in my room and she'd come back like an hour later and she'd be like, why didn't you just say this
two months ago when it happened? Right.
And I was like, I did. I like looked at you.
Yeah. You're like, you didn't pick up on the very, very subtle hints.
Yeah. But yeah, I think writing stuff down can be very powerful. I think, you know, more people should do it if they aren't already, even if you're not showing it to other people, even if you're just keeping a journal for yourself.
I feel like it kind of gets it out of it kind of clears it out of my immediate mind. Even if I'm still, I mean, it's not like you write a feeling down and you're like, that feeling's gone now. Now it's over there on the piece of paper in the trash. But for me, it's
with
just...
with my ex.
Right. Dang.
See, these are the things I need to talk about.
Yeah, for real. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it can just clear it from my immediate like emotional mind and just open up a little more space for like a different feeling.
Yeah. How do you feel between writing a happy song and writing a sad song? Is there any difference in effort or mindset? Does one flow more easily than the other?
Sad songs flow from my pores. For me, it's harder to write a happy song. I feel like mainly because I feel like they come off like cheesy or something. Like it's hard to write a happy song that doesn't sound cheesy. Yeah. Even when we're making a song called Magic on this EP, I remember singing that line and it just kind of came out. And I was like, can we really say you make me believe in magic? Like, isn't that the lamest thing ever? And we're both kind of like, I don't know. Let's find out. And then you just kind of build the rest of the song around it. And by the end, I was like, I think this is fucking dope. I love it. Like, it doesn't feel... Trying to just kind of... My experience writing happy songs is very limited. But I think trying to just let stuff flow out rather than trying to make it... Like, let's make this a happy song now. That has never worked for me. But especially making this EP, it's like the happiest thing I've ever released in it. And it was all kind of done very naturally. Where it's just like, that just started falling out. So let's chase it and see. And if it's cheesy at the end, we can throw it in the trash can.
Yeah, I think a lot of people too just don't like seeing other people that are happy sometimes. Like I feel like if some guy's just too happy on social media or maybe everything.
Right, you're like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
Yeah, you're like, what's going on with this guy? Like, let's tear him down a little bit. He's a little bit too happy and it kind of makes you like a target. But
it's like the worst part of Instagram in the whole world. I unfollowed everyone because... I was tired of seeing everyone.
You just
so
have a
happy.
Select few.
Literally unfollowed. It's my feed is me.
<That's>
Which
smart.
Maybe there's something wrong with that. But I just, I mean, it's such, like, it's become such a cliche thing, kind of like the Instagram life. But I don't know. It's just that feeling of like constantly feeling like, well, that person's doing this. I should be doing that. I'm doing nothing. Or like, I have this cool thing, but that person has the better one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mine was on the middle shelf. There was on the top shelf. Why didn't I get that one? Or whatever it is. And even in work and stuff, seeing people making stuff with this person or that person or that person, it can just so easily like rip away any sense of like joy. And I feel like especially for like gratitude, it can just like kind of destroy that. So I was just like, fuck this. I still creep on like everyone that I've ever met.
Yeah, you have to creep. You gotta figure out what's going on in the world.
But, yeah. I'm like, I still want to know what everyone's doing secretly, yeah. but
I don't want to. I don't want to feel bad about it.
I want to have to like look for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
Instagram's weird. I don't know. I feel like social media in general is weird just because we evolved at the level of only knowing what goes on in a small group of people. Like thousands of years ago, you just knew what was going on in your small village or like your own small little area, corner of the earth. And like that was the gossip. But now you can find out what everyone else is doing around the world
right, at any point. Forever.
But people are only posting the top 1%. Right. And so that starts to become normalized. Whereas, you know, even 50 years ago, what, 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Totally.
Yeah. Like you would just see a more, it wasn't totally authentic because there's still other type of technologies, but now it's just the instant feed with Twitter and Instagram where you're just getting pelted with a small slice of someone else's life that they want you to see.
Right.
And so it's like a carefully curated thing of how can I make people think that I'm like living my best life.
Totally. And it's that whole thing of what's the cliche, don't compare the worst in you to the best in someone else or something. So if you're looking at everybody's thing and being like, they're so happy and they have a Gucci bag and like, I'm sad and I don't, or whatever it is. Like the littlest things I feel like can end up like sending me into like a existential crisis of like, what is my life purpose again? Like, yeah, what am I doing
here? You start to question yourself, or even you could be
sitting at home eating avocado toast every day.
You could be sitting at home so content about what you're doing. Maybe you decide to stay in on a Friday or Saturday and you're just reading a book or listening to a podcast or something. And right. then you flip through your Instagram for 5 minutes.
And you're,
and
like,
did I fuck up?
Right. I think I need to go to the gym. I think I need to like whatever.
Yeah. Something I wanted to get into. And if people are not aware of your backstory, for people that are listening to this podcast right now, you came out when you were about 22 or 23.
Something like that, yeah.
So
I blacked it out.
somewhere back there in the trauma that you were talking about before. Also, having been part of the church, I was interested in what did that do to your identity as a person, and how were you handling the rhetoric that you were hearing in church? And I had it a lot because I was in a Catholic school and I'm straight, but like there's still a lot of, what's the word for it? Hypocrisy in the Catholic Church, where they say, we're all accepting everyone, love your neighbor, love everyone, but these people, they're going to hell.
Right.
And I would be going to hell right now because I don't go to church technically. For you, how are you handling that as in the Christian church, but also being gay and being in the closet at the time?
Oh, I'm straight, bro.
No. Yeah. I'm straight now.
I turned straight. Yeah. That's how I handle
that. Dude, that's, people try to do that. That's like another podcast.
They sure do. It was weird. It was a weird thing. I was like kind of removed from the church I was at, which was weird. I met my first boyfriend at church, which is so funny.
Like removed, they removed you.
Yeah. There's something in the Bible that's where it's fucked. Like you do this thing first. You like call, what you do to unrepentant sinners is like you call them out in private. Then you take it to a church elder and then you like call them out in public and then you fucking kick them out.
So you went through that whole process.
Yeah, I didn't know that until like at the end they were like, oh no, it's right here in the Bible. We did this. And I was like, damn.
Yeah.
like an instruction manual. Silver linings playbook on me. And so it was weird. It was really hard because I think like, I mean, I'm gay, and then also having like, so much of your identity kind of tied up in the church was hard because you have like two parts of your, no worries, mother.
The power of editing.
But you have these two kinds of things that you're being told like completely don't fit together. So I went on like a quest to find churches that were accepting and kind of celebrated my community and who I was. And I found a bunch, which was nice. I don't go to church now. I don't really have a desire to, but it was nice to find places that were supportive, like St. Thomas and Hollywood Boulevard that gives you Oreos in a mug.
Yeah.
I don't really
steal their idea.
So I'll go sometimes. The like, you know, it's a weird when you spend so long of your life doing something and being in a, just being in that headspace kind of, mm-hmm. and being in that, even in the physical space, even like the smell of like, the incense that they burn or something like that. You just have these like sensory flashbacks, like, mm-hmm. oh my God. As I kind of was coming out of that, I was finding these places and because I never really, I don't know, it was one of the darkest kind of chapters of my life and just the most confusing because you're just kind of like, well, if I'm this, then I can't be this. But if I'm this, then I can't be this. And I think the hardest, in hindsight, kind of, I think the worst thing that a person can do is kind of take the voice of a person and kind of funnel the voice of God into that and kind of like just using something like that against someone when it's like, you don't, so many churches are like, well, you know, we don't know the wonders of God or we don't know, like there's so much we don't know, but then it's like, you're like, I'm gay. And like, well, we know you can't be that. And it's like, well, you just said how you don't really know.
Yeah, they're like, light, God works in mysterious ways, except.
Right. But if you're gay, then you can't.
We know he
you
said
can't
that.
Sit with
that.
Yeah. And I don't think that people realize what that does. I'm like a little scared to say the word like brainwashed, but it gets that vibe.
I mean, there's definitely a good bit of brainwashing going on in the Catholic Church. Just from kind of like what we were talking about before, like the call and response. Like if you were going to brainwash someone,
right, it's like say
take notes
now.
From the Catholic Church and have people repeat shit and then believe it and then go out and convert other people to believe the same thing.
It's just, I think sometimes people don't realize what their words can do to a person and how, like if... Like growing up, you hear about this God that loves everyone. It's all loving, all loving, all loving, all loving, all loving. And then you come out and they're like, you can't come here anymore. You're an unrepentant sinner. Mm-hmm. We don't love you. And it's like, well, I guess I never said we don't love you. That's the crux. That's how they get away with it. Well, love the sinner, hate the sin.
Well, it's weird how they cherry pick some sins and quotes over others. Like what if you're just having premarital sex, like they wouldn't have probably kicked you out of the church for that.
Please stop.
Yeah.
Right.
They'd be like, stop that. You can still come here.
There's an author called Rachel Held Evans that's really good. I think did she just pass away? Which is so sad. So young. But she wrote a book called A Year of Biblical Womanhood that was so good, where she just lived out for a year everything that the Bible says a woman should do. Which is like when you're on your period, she slept outside. And like when her husband was coming home from out of town, she greeted him at, it's like says something about greeting him at the gates of the city. And she went to the billboard that says like, welcome to whatever the city is with like a sign that says like, welcome home, hubby. And she did all this crazy shit just to show people like when you're talking about, you know, like when a church kicks a gay person out, they're saying, this is what's biblical. And so she was just like, you want to know what's biblical is all of this. So if you're going to make the defense that like, this is biblical, it's like you better be sleeping outside and like doing all this crazy shit. And I thought it was so smart. And it was also really just eye-opening because it was, I think, so it rings so true. There's no real argument to be like, well, or like, what's the argument to be like, this is literally biblical. It's right here. And that's, I think, where stuff just got so... I also went to a church, I think it was called All Saints, and they had a
pamphlet.
That's
a good clothing store too.
I know. True. I met a boyfriend there one time. But they had
a
pamphlet. No comment.
False advertising.
They had a pamphlet that says Jesus' teachings on homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And then you open it and it's empty. And then when you get to the back, it says, this is not a misprint because he doesn't say anything about it, which is also kind of that in her book, like kind of open way, where you're just having these moments of like, whoa, that's like crazy.
I would say, I don't know what percentage of people consider themselves kind of like the mainstream Christians where you go to church, but you don't really follow the Bible, or it's like kind of a moderate influence in your life. I would think that's most people, but then you have other people that are just more devout and orthodox in that sense, where they just take everything in the Bible literally, which is crazy.
I find that there's a lot more of that than, I mean, the church I was at in LA was like cool church.
Yeah.
You would think like, oh, they're all good. The pastor has like tattoos, but there are just these certain issues where it's like, nope, not that. And it's like, what? Like, okay.
I don't know. Like, I think going, like being in that structure, I don't know if you've listened to Sam Harris at all. He has a podcast. He's a neuroscientist, talks a lot about religion. Mm. And he talks about how if you are going to follow a book for morality and spirituality, the Bible, which is put on a pedestal, is like one of the worst things that you can follow. Like when people think of morality and being a good person, the Bible is usually what pops into your head. But it was written thousands of years ago, and you can literally, he says this, he's like, you can literally walk into the bookstore, into the spiritual section, pick anything up off the shelf besides the Bible and get more out of that being a good person than actually following the Bible. So I was like, that's pretty true considering all the shit that's in there.
Yeah.
So to get into songwriting, you've written with people like Adam Lambert, Kesha, Ellie Goulding, Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
Mentioned that a little bit last night. What was that like, having the chance to work with the Backstreet Boys in their, like, the second coming there?
Yeah, the comeback. Yeah,
speaking of the, it's just in my right. head. The second coming of the Backstreet Boys.
We were born again. It was awesome. It was so surreal. I mean, I remember like going to Walmart at midnight when their records would come out and buying it and like geeking out and listening to it for months and months and months.
I was there with you. I had Backstreet Boys. I had 98 Degrees.
Yeah, 98 Degrees.
Aaron Carter. So good.
Aaron Carter. NSYNC.
Good times.
Christina, Britney.
Yep.
Mandy Moore.
Throwbacks.
But yeah, it was so surreal. It was really... I got an email one day that was just like, the Backstreet Boys want to cut this song. And I was like, what the fuck? Are you serious?
Yeah.
It was like, I thought somebody was kidding.
Like, is this a joke?
I was like, holy shit.
Tell me right now.
So they cut that song. I hadn't met them actually when they recorded Don't Go Breaking My Heart. But then it kind of opened the door to go in and I did another song called Chateau with them. And then I got to actually go in and help vocal produce them, which was like, we did like backgrounds where we're all standing around a mic. And I was just like, what the fuck? This is the fucking Backstreet Boys. I'm a Backstreet Boy right now.
Yeah.
And they were so nice. They were so, so nice. And just very respectful and really good guys and not like egos or anything like that. Like you could tell that they were so appreciative and of what they've been able to do and of being able to like put out a song, when did it come out? Last year?
Mm-hmm.
And have it like go. Like, I heard that on the radio. So my mom heard it on the radio twice in the same Uber ride from LAX to my apartment.
That's awesome.
And I was like, dang, that's dope.
It must be pretty cool from the Backstreet Boys perspective to be in the spotlight for so long and then get to take a break for a while and then come back and have a new perspective and
totally
kind of just live life for, you know, whatever it was, 10, 15 years, and then just be like, I kind of feel like making music again because your following was so strong
right.
when you originally started putting out music.
Yeah, and to see the fans like really react in such a positive way.
Yeah.
And the residency in Vegas is, I still haven't seen it. I'm so mad at myself. But I see clips of like their shows. They just, I don't know if they're on it now or they just finished a crazy world tour. And just seeing like everyone in the freaking world singing along is so cool. To be like, oh my God, I wrote that song. That's the Backstreet Boys. And everyone singing along. What the fuck?
Speaking of linking up with songwriters, I was reading another interview that you had done where you talk about cold emailing or messaging people on MySpace in the day. I think that's a very effective strategy, especially trying to build up a podcast and get people to interview. I didn't realize how responsive some people would be.
Totally.
And I thought it was a joke at first, looking at Facebook pages or SoundCloud and seeing their email. I'm like, that's not his email.
Right.
And then I emailed the whoever artist it is and he or she will hit me back. Sometimes, like at the beginning, it's kind of hard to get going. You get told so many no's that you're just like, oh, fuck this. But you just keep sending emails. But it's cool to be able to cold reach out to people and to be able to have the strength to accept no's, which I'm sure there were a lot at the beginning when you're trying to get people to collab.
Yeah, especially when you're working with like a MySpace with like, hey man, I just moved out to LA. I'm 19 and here's my songs that I made in my fucking garage. Do you want to hang out? But yeah, that's something I still do sometimes.
Now you have the power of the verified check.
Yeah, I guess
right
I have
to the right to the inbox.
Even with like emails or something, like not that long ago, I was like, I wrote a song with my friends and then I was like, this would be dope if so-and-so sang this. And they were like, oh my God, I met with their manager 4 years ago. And I was like, you want to email them? They're like, no, I haven't seen them in 4 years. Like, yeah. And I was like, what's the email address? And I'm just like sitting there typing it out and being like, I don't know, send, to no response. But even sending songs to people or whatever, like, I don't know. I think some level of that is always good to have because it's just like, there become at some point so many people involved. You have like I have a manager, a publisher, and they're both kind of taking angles. And then sometimes like I have gotten on Instagram and been like, I'm going to DM this song to fill in the blank because whatever, and have gotten responses and haven't gotten a cut from it. But it's like, I don't know. Sometimes that stuff can't hurt. And I feel like you can't really be afraid of no, but you don't really have anything to lose.
That's what I always tell myself. If I'm ever feeling self-conscious about sending a message or getting in touch with someone, the worst thing that's going to happen is that they just don't reply or they say no.
Imagine you're like, I'm going to freaking DM Britney Spears this song. And then she's like, I love this. Yeah. You'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And it's a 30...
She loves Instagram.
It's 30 seconds effort on your part to send an email that could potentially lead to incredible connections.
Totally.
Putting you in a better financial position, furthering your career. And you see so many people that they kind of, and I had this at the beginning too. Like I've only been doing this for about a year, but I still think about it sometimes where you want to reach out to someone and then you think in your head, you're like, oh, well, they're never going to get back to me, or like, they're never going to read this.
Right.
And a lot of my friends will talk kind of like that negative way in other projects that they're doing, like whether it's in business or music, podcasting, law, whatever it is. They'll be like, oh, like, you know, this, it's not going to work. Like they'll never get back to me. And
then it's like, all it takes is one.
Like literally just send that person a message. Like just send.
Cool. Right.
Send it. Totally. If you're listening to this, just send it.
Send it.
Unless it's a text message.
Then do not send.
Yeah.
Do not send. That's funny. Don't text the ex. Do you know
what you can't do ever,
even above that, is fucking call them. That's the worst thing you can do.
I've never called, but I have texted many times.
It's the worst idea in the whole entire universe.
What makes a call worse than the text?
Because then it's just like there. It's like there. It's right there. It's real. It's like one step short of like hello.
Yeah. I guess Skype would be pretty bad too.
Skype would be weird because I don't even know if anybody's really
if they're
Skyping.
Just with someone else and they're oh shit.
I feel like they'd be like, I still have Skype.
FaceTime.
Sorry, Skype.
Texting, I feel like when you first get out of a breakup or first get out of a relationship, you just automatically unfollow them so you don't have the reminders to text them.
Yeah.
And then if I do text my ex, the last time I was in a relationship was maybe two and a half years ago. So if I did text her, I was most likely drunk and then I would just delete it while I was drunk. And then sometimes I would forget that I even sent it.
That's good.
And so she would text me back the next morning and I'd be like, that's a weird way to start a conversation. Right. Like, don't ever text me again. Why did
what kind of hello is that?
Yeah, what? I haven't talked to you in years.
Anyways, I miss you. Yeah. Skype me.
Tough waters to navigate.
So I used to have a phone case that said, don't text your ex.
You need that on the front.
That's what I was like.
You need it as your background.
Right.
I think this was the the same interview. I need to look up who this was. It might have been Sidewalk Talks. But yeah, so you mentioned that when you first got to LA, you were doing a bunch of sessions back to back, like two sessions a day. I think that a lot of people that are successful, especially singers and songwriters, people in the music industry in general, they have a period where they hyper produce at the beginning and they're just like going through and through experimenting, seeing what works. Was that kind of like your mentality behind that phase, or what were you thinking when you first got to LA? How are you trying to produce?
I think I thought that's what you had to do. And that was also, I feel like even the mentality of LA and even the songwriting kind of world has shifted a little bit, because I think it did used to feel like that's what you had to do. You were just like working. And there are still some people that are writing that are like doing that and having great success. But I think you find whatever works best, you know, for you. I've learned that I don't work well at that. I had a writer ask me not long ago, like, do you ever do doubles? And I was like, I barely do singles.
It's a back-to-back session, yeah.
And I'll do a double every now and then if there's something that I really love. The last double I did, actually, both those songs came out, which is crazy. So maybe there's actually something to it, and I'm just a total idiot and need to start doing that more. But I think it took me, I've been out in LA for like 11 years, so it took me a long time to find the balance. And then even now, I find myself constantly reevaluating, like, how much work is good? How much work pushes you the right amount to where you're a little outside of your zone and you get a little buzzy and those weird breakthrough moments happen? And how much like recharge do you need to actually, especially when you're creating something, like it's so weird and there's no formula or anything. Or if there is, like, Max Martin needs to tell us what it is, because then we could all work out less. Tunes. So for me, I don't know. I feel like it's finding the balance of like seasons of just like, and then being able to be like, no, like 3 days a week.
I feel like some of that goes back to social media too, because everyone always posts about like the hustling and how hard they work. And like, it feels good to throw up a post of showing you doing stuff. And then when you're not working, you start to feel guilty about it. You're like, should I be working right now?
And I like shade so much on the like 2 a.m. geotagged post at the studio with the timestamp on it. That's like still writing. And I'm like, still bitch, grinding. I'm in bed eating cake with a face mask on. Like, calm down. Yeah. But I'm totally guilty of doing that same thing. Because probably the night I did that double, I was probably tagging like, oh no, I'm still working. It's so late. I'm so cool. Yeah. But I think that it is kind of just trying to find the balance and trying to find everybody like works best in different situations. Even I used to work at night all the time. And now it's like, oh my God, it's got to be like my best friend in the world, or like Cher.
So you're one of those.
Cher, if Cher's listening to this right
now.
Let's
start at midnight. That's funny. So you work like better in the mornings now?
I don't know if I go that far into the morning, but like day.
When you wake, just after like you wake up, like a couple hours after
I like
you wake
to
up.
Be done like in time to like go out for dinner and like chill and like feel like I have a night.
Sometimes
I go home and have another morning. If I finish by like 6, I go home, have a cup of coffee, like take another shower, put on a different outfit. And I'm like, all right, let's go.
I don't know if you feel this way too, but when I wake up and kind of go through the waking up process, doing whatever your morning routine is, an hour after I wake up from that time till about 4 hours later, I have a window where I can be productive doing like creative things where I'm trying to figure stuff out or coming up with ideas or trying to, you know, put together something for a podcast. And then after 4 hours, my brain is just fried. And then maybe I could do more administrative stuff later at night, like sending emails or just things that I don't need brain power for.
Right.
I was never able to work at night.
Sometimes it's fun. I have one friend that I work with quite a bit and that likes to write at night, but like at 5. So then you're still home by like midnight. And it's fun because if you know you're going to do that, you sleep in a little bit. But I don't know. The other day I started a session at 10 a.m. and I was like, really? But it was so fun. We ended up writing like 2 full songs by 1 p.m. and then leaving. And I was like, and we had lunch. I was like, what? Maybe this is my every day. 10 to 1.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel ready to get after it in the morning.
3 hours. I'm like, I'm done. Thank you.
I mean, that's a solid day. I mean, if you're...
Let's see if anything gets cut.
If you're getting...
That can give me...
If you're getting more work done in a shorter amount of time, right, then why not?
That's
work
what made me think
less
of that when you were like, oh, I have this window an hour after I wake up. And I was like, an hour after I wake up, I'm usually still waking up.
I've experimented a lot with my morning routine. I've done, right now it's, I meditate for between 10 and 20 minutes, which I never used to do. I take a cold shower.
I've heard of this cold showering thing.
Cold showers wake you the fuck up. You can't.
And it's also like good for something.
It's good for skin. It's good for your hair follicles because your pores get tight.
And isn't it good for like your brain chemicals or like your...
Something with your... I think it raises your HGH and testosterone production so you get more energy. I don't know. There are people that can speak on the science behind it way better than I can. I think I originally heard it on a podcast with Joe Rogan, but just coming from a personal...
Let's get Joe on the line.
Yeah, let's get it. Manoa, call him up. Just from...
He didn't pick up.
Damn. Fuck Joe. I know you're listening to this. So just from my own experience, you know, hopping in the cold shower, I think one, it wakes you up. You can't take a cold shower. You could be dead tired at the end of a 16-hour day, and then a cold shower will keep you up for at least another hour. Like you won't be able to fall asleep. It like just supercharges you.
I take like a, not only do I take a hot shower, but I also put a heater on in
so you don't feel cold
bathroom
when you walk
so
out.
So nothing is cold.
So that's what I like about the cold showers because you don't feel
that weird, terrible
you
feeling.
You want to get out of the shower.
As soon as you take like the most relaxing shower and then you step outside of the shower and you're like, well, everything has just been reversed.
Yeah. So when you take a cold shower, the air outside feels warm to you. So you like want
to
get out.
It's
so
like
my cold
pool
showers. Yeah.
And it's cold and then you go in and then you get out and then you go back in and it's like, wow.
Yeah. So my cold showers are probably 3 or 4 minutes. So it saves time. It's good for your skin. I have more energy at least. And then when I take warm showers, I don't know why, but I just feel tired and dehydrated when I get out. And so I just started doing it.
You could bring like a beverage in there with you.
I should start bringing like...
My dad used to have like a Budweiser on the thing. Like just like chilling.
We did that in college a lot. Did like Natty Light showers
Natty
after practice.
Light showers.
Yeah. I mean, that was just because we were poor college kids that would buy a 30 rack of Natty Lights for
right for like
10 bucks.
Bucks.
Yeah.
Totally.
And be like, yeah, this is
I
pretty
spent
cool.
Time in Texas. I know the drill.
Speaking of Natty Light, I know you got sober twice.
Yes.
What was going on in your life before you got sober for the final time, and what made you want to make the decision to actually go through with it? Because I'm sure a lot of people are on the fence about it and never make the decision to do it, or they relapse a bunch of times. Well, what was kind of going through your mind?
I was sober almost 5 years, which I'm coming up on 5 years in February. So I'm a little like, are those sirens for me? I drank for like 10 months probably. And I got DUI in Burbank County. And that was kind of like my come to Jesus moment. Because I was just, it was just so dark. I had just gotten so, so dark. None of it was like, none of it was super fun. Or like it would be fun until, that's like such a cliche, but it was fun until it wasn't. But it really was that kind of, it really was fun until it wasn't. And just feeling completely out of control. Just like drinking literally every day. And going into work drunk and drinking through work and kind of thinking like, oh, this is cute or this is like glamorous or like whatever. Like I'm in a really dope recording studio with a bottle of Tito's in my Marc Jacobs backpack. Yeah. This is awesome. I'm like a diva. And then being like, no, you're just an alcoholic.
Now I have my Oreos in my podcast mug.
Right, totally. Yeah, it just got dark. And kind of before I started drinking, I went through a breakup and was just, I stayed sober through my coming out process, which was, I almost didn't. The week after I came out, I bought booze every single day for 5 days and one of my best friends, Yaz, would come literally like leave work, drive to the studio I was at, mm-hmm. and I would unlock my car and she would take it out of my backseat and like take it
She'd
away.
She'd be like, no, Steven. Uh-huh. That's a good friend.
That's a really good friend. She's still one of my best friends. And she does a bunch of like creative direction work for me now, which is so fun to get to work with her. But yeah, it just got really dark. And I went through a breakup and then into a new relationship and then broke up out of that one. And it just felt so, with work, I had transitioned out of a label deal and was kind of working independent and was really confused as to what that was going to be like. I was actually, no, that happened right as I got sober. Because I remember my managers came to the rehab center and we had a meeting with my therapist, like maybe 5 days before I was supposed to get out. And they were like, just to let you know, we're transitioning out of the label and like, it's going to be okay and whatever, whatever. And then I was like, just so you know, I'm going to stay here for another month because now I'm freaking out.
Yeah. Is rehab what it looks like in movies and TV shows where it's just like you all get in a circle and...
Pretty much. I went to one place that was really, it was billed as really fancy and nice and it kind of was. The treatment there was a little jank and they were doing some suspect stuff. Like there were people coming in for inspections and stuff while I was there. There's a lot of shady stuff with rehabs because I think a lot of people come in now to make cash because you can charge fucking 50 grand a month or whatever. And it's like...
To go to rehab? Yeah. That's some of them cost 50K a month?
Yeah.
That's insane. Crazy.
And then I needed to stay. I just knew I wasn't ready to come back to the world. And so Music Cares through the Grammy Foundation set me up with this place called Milestones in Malibu that was like so awesome. It was like just the treatment was amazing. And the people there were so kind and loving and compassionate and the perfect balance of like love and tough love, which the first place I went to, there was no tough love. I don't do well with tough love, but I feel like I'm a fucking drug addict, alcoholic, like psychopath. I need help and had somebody there that really kind of changed my life.
What are some of the mindsets or maybe exercises that they have you do in rehab that help you stay sober from day to day?
We did a lot of meditation stuff. I think sobriety, my understanding of it is that it's so unique to each person. I never got into like AA really. Mm-hmm. The first time I got sober, I went to like 100 meetings in the first 90 days because I say do 90 and 90, which is like the song 90 days that I've made, which is like kind of stolen from AA. But the second time I didn't really go. I go if I feel fucking crazy. If I feel like I want to fucking drink, then I'll go find a meeting.
Yeah.
But I found that I just ended up just changing how I kind of tried to communicate with myself and with the people that were closest to me and to try to be okay more with. It's funny even talking back to like shows and stuff. Like sometimes I find it easier to be vulnerable with a stranger because I'm never going to see you again in my life. So if you walk up to me and you're like, oh my God, like, how are you? It's so good to meet you. I love your music, whatever, whatever. And then you start talking for 30 minutes and I'm like, honestly, like I'm having a kind of a shitty hard day and like whatever. Sometimes something like that is easier than calling my best friend and being like, I don't know what's going on with me, but like, I feel fucking sad as fuck today. I don't know why.
I wrote down a quote that you said while I was stalking your interviews, if that isn't apparent at this point, but you said, I'm open except for the people who are closest to me, which I really identify with because I can have someone on the podcast and talk like this for an hour.
Yeah.
And I'm fine. And then my mom or someone else in my family
will be trying
to like extract information out of me.
You're like,
I'm just
no.
like, stop fucking trying to get inside my head, which I need to get better at. But I was like, there was one time where I don't know why, but I had a mental block about just telling my dad, I love you. Like texting him because he said it to me and he doesn't say it a lot, but I was just like, fuck, like, why is this so weird right now? Like, I can talk about anything.
Right.
But then when it comes to my own family, it's just like, oh. Like,
and there's so many, especially family, there's so many, I think, dynamics that like, from being a kid even, that like, kind of never wear off completely. Or like, when there's any sort of drama, it's like, everyone turns into like, the 8-year-old version of themselves. It's like, I'm going to go sit in my room and play loud music or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to do the dishes.
So to go back to the Tito's and Marc Jacobs bag in the studio. Yeah.
Dope.
It does sound
dope even when you say it. I'm like, damn. It does sound dope.
It's like the rock star lifestyle.
It was so tragic.
How do you feel about creating sober versus creating fucked up? Because some people swear by creating fucked up. Some people are like, oh, I don't need it. How do you feel about it?
I was writing a lot with one of my best friends and we ended up getting sober right around the same time. And we were writing a lot together drunk. And I think both of us kind of felt dependent on that. I always felt like we were making such awesome stuff. And then in hindsight, when I listen to it now, I'm like, not really. A lot of them were big old misses. But I think it kind of is, it's easy if you're creating kind of fucked up. Even you just hear stories of like every iconic rock star ever. A lot of them are fucking dead because of addiction or because of substance or because of overdose or whatever it is. And so it's so sad and it's so, but at the same time, it's still so romanticized as like, it's the tortured artist. Like they needed that, or like the drugs help you get in touch with, you know, the creative mystical spirit or whatever. And I think that that's really, really dangerous to kind of romanticize. And I think there have been a lot more stories told now, I think, of like, no, this is actually just drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really sad. Even like the Amy Winehouse documentary was like
to watch
so eye-opening and heartbreaking to see, like, even her, I remember that stuff going on and, you know, seeing it in real time kind of. And I felt like the world was looking at it as like this romantic kind of tortured artist, like going crazy and whatever. And then it's like, no, this is like textbook drug addiction. This is so sad and nobody's really helping her. So I definitely did fall into a trap of feeling like I can't create without that, because that's it, like it's the oil in the tank or whatever. But then creating sober, once I kind of got going, I feel so much better, because I feel like I'm able to actually be more intentional with what I'm doing. And kind of be more present. Because if you're fucked up, you're literally not in the room. Mm-hmm. So you can't really, as
black
much
out,
as you think.
Blackout, make three songs.
Kind of. And I've had some, like, even like the Kesha song Woman, like I was fucked up and we were writing that. And it was fun. Like I have a tattoo that says it was fun I got for my second year of sobriety. Because I wanted to remember, like, it was fun. Otherwise I wouldn't.
Were you with Kesha when you were writing that song, or was it?
Yeah.
So you guys were just in the studio
drinking like rosé. Yeah.
It does sound like fun.
It was so fun. But that was like the rare fun day in that mix. Cause there were so many that days where I'm just like going into the room with strangers and like I'm secretly fucked up thinking that people don't know. I remember passing the boxed water.
Yeah, like the white carton box. Yeah, yeah. It's like box water. Yeah.
I remember with one of my best friends, we had this session that was one of the darkest days of us passing one of those back and forth, refilling it with rosé for like an 8-hour long session, thinking that the producer has no idea.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, ooh, I'm just so thirsty. I'm going to have some more of this boxed water that we've been sharing for the past 4 hours.
Yeah.
Are you thirsty?
It's like, why are there 4 empty wine bottles on the floor?
Like, and one box of water. Yeah.
Where's it going?
Cap. Yeah. That's like slowly wilting.
Yeah.
So I think I'm really thankful to be where I'm at right now. And it's not, it's still like, I don't think it ever, ever goes away. But especially in a creative space, like that's the last space that I want to bring that back to. Like when the light at the end of the tunnel kind of goes away, that's when I start freaking out and feeling like, what did I used to reach for? But especially in a creative space, like I don't even really work with people. Like I worked with somebody that opened a bottle of Casamigos the other day in a session. And after the session, I was like, I'm never going to work with that person again. Just because it's not a safe environment. Mm-hmm. Not that people
If you told that person, would they be like, oh, okay, like I won't drink, or do you think they would just...
Well, that was like a instance, that was a loaded situation.
Yeah.
But that's not my place to speak. But no, I don't think so. I mean, and I have friends that sometimes would drink in a session where I'm just like, they know, just like, don't do that.
Yeah. I think
but some people are just still kind of like in that thing where it's like, let's get fucked up and write a song. And I'm like, you guys do that, I'm going to go to the mall.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It is romanticized, especially in music. And, you know, as a listener, when you're hearing artists write music and they talk about how they're fucked up writing the music and the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just like, wake up, you know, smoke a blunt, drink some whiskey, go to the studio. And then you can think that's the best way to create. Like, if I'm not doing this, am I not tapping into something within myself? And yeah, like, I mean, there have been some podcasts where if we're doing it later in the day or something, and someone's like, do you mind if I just drink on the podcast? And I'll join them. And then the conversation goes really well. Then you start to wonder, should I just do this every single time?
Because
it lowers your inhibitions. You feel like I feel like it's a constant process of saying what's on your mind without feeling insecure about it, which podcasting definitely taps into that. But alcohol kind of really quickens that state. Until it goes too far.
Right.
Where you're like just shit.
Yeah, you're like, what happened?
Yeah, you're like, no, there's absolute like garbage just coming out of my mouth right now. But yeah, I think that's like what's, at least for me, what makes me second guess myself, where like things go well when I do drink. And then I'm like, well, do I need to do this every time? When I go out, do I do this every time? And it's hard to go somewhere without, like, especially in New York City and LA, without hanging out and drinking, because it's like an activity. Just like, oh, I don't know what we're going to do today.
Right.
Like, let's just go drink.
And then you're like, come to, and you're in the trunk of an Escalade with six strangers. And you're like, what happened? Where are we going?
Yeah.
Is there a line?
Yeah. It's like three people in masks. They're like, we're going to a session.
Right. Oh my God. Hysterical. I'm like, all right, I'm down.
Well, on that note, I want to be conscious of your time and thank you for coming by the studio and hanging out and talking about church and Oreos and Tito's. And it was a very wide-ranging conversation.
For sure. Thank you. I really
people get a lot
time.
Out of this. And your music is incredible. Your show is incredible. I'll link everything, social media,
awesome.
Music to the podcast. And yeah, this is a blast. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
All right. We're out.
Mic drop.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode with Rabel. You can stream his music now with the link in the description of this podcast. You can also go follow him on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. All of that information will be in the podcast description as well. And if you haven't already, it would really help us out if you could go rate us 5 stars on iTunes, leave a comment, post a blog, tag us on social media. If you love this podcast, let the people that you love know, because that's how other people find out about Auxoro. We are a completely independent platform. We are not part of a bigger podcasting label, and we rely on you, the listeners, to help spread the word. So thank you for everyone that tuned in to this episode, that is lending us your presence to be here for this conversation. You are the reason why we do what we do, and it does not go unnoticed. We are grateful for everyone who listens, everyone who tunes in, DMs, sends emails. It fires us up. We love that shit. So keep doing it, and I will see you guys next time.